Here's our world. Beautiful and terrible things will happen. Be not afraid, because this is what we are about, you and I. We hold hope for each other when hope is hard to find. We plant seeds that will one day grow. We are prophets of a future not our own. We cannot do everything, but we can do something. So let us this new year forget our perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That is how the light gets in. The Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist Dave Barry, who is way funnier and often more insightful than just about any other columnist you will read, began his annual year in review by saying that he'd heard the critics that say the news always focuses on the negative, and instead was going to start with some top 10 good things that happened in 2015. And he started his list like this. Number one, we did not hear much about reality TV star Honey Boo Boo. And it's true, we didn't. But when he got to number two, Barry stopped, saying he couldn't think of anything else because 2015 was so negative. It's like we're on the Titanic, he said, and it's lilting at 85 degrees. The propellers are up in the air, and we're dangling over the cold ocean, trying to tell ourselves, hey, at least there's no line for shuffleboard. This is the version of Heather's story where you pop the umbrella inside and say, I can't wait. But along with Barry, I've heard the critics, I've been one of them actually, who feel that we miss noticing the long arc of love because we're so wrapped with the latest horror right in front of our faces. We're so wrapped. So this year I'm inviting all of us to adopt a mood that I'm calling, I want you to adopt it with me, called willful hope. Okay? Willful hope. As we look back over the top religious stories of the year, remembering as we do so that when it comes to religion, as with all things, it is so much easier to be ironic, sarcastic, or cynical than it is affirming, hopeful, or loving. So deep breath with me and breathe out, remembering as we share my top 10 religious news stories of 2015 that mine is a free pulpit and yours is a free pew, which means that I get to speak my heart and you, should you be so inclined, get to disagree with me, because together that is how you and I grow. We don't, in this church, try to go to the lowest common denominator where we keep everybody happy, because that doesn't help. All right, number 10. And I had fun coming up with these titles. Number 10, but you're too pretty to be a nun. In a year when the Pew Forum for Religion, it's the regular predictor of demographic gloom and doom about all things churchy, in case you didn't know. In the year that reported that more young adults than ever are leaving institutions just like this, saying that they have failed them somehow. Guess what one of the most popular blogs in Huffington Post was? You're wondering, was it some mockery of the Kardashians? Was it maybe some tongue-in-cheek essay about Lindsay Miller, the Lowell resident who appealed to the Massachusetts DMV to wear a spaghetti strainer on her head, saying it was part of her beliefs as a member of the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster, mocking all of us in the process? Was it one of those, you're wondering? Surprisingly, no. In an age of the spiritual but not religious, and when I'm often asked, when people learn what I do, to apologize on behalf of everyone's religions in the world, one of the most read blogs was in fact written by Angela Savak, a 27-year-old Illinois native who used to work for the cosmetic giant Clinique and peruses Pinterest for fashion inspiration, who also wants to be a nun. and who is also beautiful. Listen to her. When I tell people I'm going to be a nun, they are shocked. But you're too normal to be a nun. I want us to listen to the prejudice, okay? You're too smart to be a nun. You're too pretty. Listen to Angela. She says, their questions have forced me to confront my self-image. Who do I see in the mirror? How do I appear in God's eyes? How does one affect the other? When I lived with the Poor Clare nuns in Bellevue, Illinois, I discovered that their monastery has no mirrors. At first, it was a shock for this cosmetic junkie, she says, but it became incredibly liberating. I felt free to be who God designed me to be and more fully attuned to the people around me and not my own reflection. I could pour the energy I used to invest in my appearance, fretting over the reflection in the mirror, trying to alter it, and I could pour that energy into my own spiritual life. Now I'm better prepared to respond when invariably someone quips that I'm too pretty for the convent. Thank you, I say, but there is no mold. God calls everybody. It doesn't matter what you look like, where you're from, or who you know, she says. Why do you think that Angela's post was so popular in a time when people apparently could care less? Why do you think? Maybe it's because they see in her, that we see in her an authenticity and a commitment to a life beyond herself and her own reflection that we are envious of, maybe. Here's to more Angelus. Number 9. By the way, my sermon is like 20 pages, so just get comfortable. Number 9. Never mind, Kim. Never mind, Starbucks. Meet me in Salt Lake. Now, while practically this year the entire country, including many of you, were getting sucked into the attention-seeking of Kim Davis, the clerk from Rowan County, Kentucky, who claimed to be speaking for the God that I believe in when she refused to sign marriage licenses for gay and lesbian people, or while the rest of us were getting all frothy with our lattes over Starbucks' decision this holiday season to serve blank red cups free from any seasonal wishes, prompting some in line to say that their names were Jesus or Merry Christmas, so the baristas would say Christmas lingo out loud. Remember, I'm not making this up. And while both of these stories and so many others were getting tagged under our newspapers with religious news of the year, while all of that was happening, and young people are saying, well, I'm not religious, I'm spiritual, the institutions have failed me. You know what? No wonder they think that. Because while all that was happening, 10,000 people, how many?
10,000.
Representing 50 different religious faiths met this fall in Salt Lake City for the Parliament of World Religions. Raise your hand if you even heard of it. Look around and notice that my hand is not up. I want you to notice that. At this parliament, was gay marriage the discussion? No. Was red cups or not red cups the discussion? No. How pretty are apparently nuns not supposed to be? Was that the discussion? No. Instead, they gather to discuss things like responding to religious violence in the world, tackling climate change, addressing income inequality. And the gathering also featured its first ever women's assembly addressing religion's role in empowering women to gain more equality in the world. And the story reminds me, and the fact that so many of us don't even know about it, including yours truly, that when people tell me that they are not religious because they see how religion tears the world apart and makes them believe 6 impossible things, no, 12 impossible things before breakfast, I want to ask them, tell me about the religion that you do not believe in, and I'll bet It is not the religion that I believe in either. Our lack of general awareness, and again I include mine here, tells me that we need to all get different Facebook feeds and read different headlines. As Thich Nhat Hanh said, just because they don't publish the good news does not mean it is not happening. Amen?
Amen.
Willful hope, remember. Number 8, can I hug you, said the woman in the hijab. I want us to imagine that out front of the church, a protester stands outside preaching words of hatred and intolerance about all of us on the inside. I just want us to imagine that. What do you do? What do you do when it comes at a time when anti-Muslim rhetoric flares in the US and Europe, as some politicians call for surveillance of Muslims and a ban on Muslim refugees, citing terrorism fears? What do you do? So in front of the Noor Islamic Cultural Center in Columbus, Ohio, this fall, police and people gathered to defend the mosque after a Facebook campaign that I bet you heard of tried to organize picketing at mosques across the country. Do you hear about that? They had all these people ready to receive all of these protesters. And they were surprised to be met with only one protester, and her name was Annie, who held two giant signs with both hands, with Islam written in the center and a big red line through them, right out front. Remember, what do you do if somebody's out front of the church holding Unitarian Universalism, big X, right? What do you do? Well, Cynthia, who's a member of the mosque, went up to Annie and asked her a very daring question. Can I give you a hug? Can I give you a hug? And what's even more surprising was the reluctant yes. Yes. Cynthia later wrote on Facebook, I felt her body go from tense to soft in her arms. And then Cynthia invited her inside. And she promised to stay by Annie's side in the mosque to provide comfort and a guarantee of safety, an offer that was quickly deemed unnecessary the moment the two women stepped into the lobby and were welcomed by a standing ovation. Annie was asked another daring question, and to everyone's surprise, she agreed to accompany the group on a complete tour of the mosque. Cynthia then led Annie to the bathroom to watch her take off her headscarf. She said so that Annie could see that I was just like her. And Annie got comfortable with Cynthia, and she confided in her that the source of her beliefs regarding Islam were two things, because she didn't know a thing about it. A friend from Turkey had told her terrible things about Islam, and she watched, because she was unemployed, a ton of cable news. By the end of the tour, which included classrooms filled with children and a glimpse of afternoon prayers and session, Anna began to ask her own questions that the president of the mosque answered with enthusiasm. And then, before she left, he handed her a gift. It was a Quran in English. Story needs no comment. Just let it sink into you. Number 7, peace on earth. I turned 44 this year. Do I look it? Okay. Yeah. That's a good answer. So whereas my two children, 15 and 12, hear all about terrorism and active shooters and sheltering in place and Jess's terrible story of guns under beds, the fear I remember assembling around in school, the teachers drilling us on how to hide under our desks and at night in 1983, me watching with my entire family the film that many of you may remember called The Day After. And my next door neighbor, the Friquettes, stocking their their fallout shelter in the backyard, 20 feet down into the ground. My fear was what? Nuclear war. The day after that film, this big mushroom cloud. Do you remember that? It was imprinted on my brain. No, on my soul. So forgive me for not taking the bait and believing with so many other people that the world is going to hell in a handbasket, because now I'm reading how this summer 350 rabbis sent a letter to Congress asking them to approve a nuclear deal with Iran. This after Netanyahu, of course, went to Congress and spoke against it. The very same letter that Obama cited as he laid out the argument for a deal struck with that country by the U.S. and five other countries, the calls for Iran to curb its nuclear weapons program and admit international inspectors. 29 leading scientists in the United States, including some of the top experts on arms control, say the accord contains the most stringent controls of any agreement ever. We lose these headlines, you and I. And not only that, because now I'm reading how Pope Francis, more on him in a bit, once again used his power in a transformative way, helping to broker a deal that opens up relations with Cuba for the first time since 1959. Cuba, the setting for the closest the world has ever come to nuclear war, when in October 1962, President Kennedy picked up the phone and was told there are missiles 90 miles from Florida. Oh yes, there is, my friends, absence of peace in the world. There is absence of that. But are we really saying that it's the only news? Are we really saying that? When religious leadership and diplomacy has ushered in greater peace than I ever thought possible as a little kid. I like this next one. Number six, how much would you bid? Think about this for auction time in March here at church. How much would you bid for Pope Francis's Harley Davidson? Throw out a number.
Zero.
Really? I think I'd bid a lot because it's a Dyna Superglide, and it's got Francesco painted on the gas tank on both sides, and it's white.
$50,000.
Okay, that's more like it. Tom, don't get Jess a motorcycle for her birthday. She might not want it. So the Vatican's planned this year, it's actually a little bit of an old headline, but it's too good to resist, auction off one of his two Harley Davidsons for the proceeds going to a soup kitchen to feed the homeless in Rome. And it was given to him by the company to mark their 110th anniversary. The real question, though, is what does he do with the other one? I just see him out there, right? But listen, this pope has made my top 10 list ever since he became pope. And this is because, like the saint that he took his name from, he has been to us and me as a former Catholic, a messenger of peace and humility. He visited all of the Americas. He challenged the wealthy and powerful in the name of the poor and the weak. He used his most powerful tool of the encyclical to address climate change. More on that later. He spoke to Congress. He made John Boehner cry, which is not a big deal because he always cries. But listen, that same week, John Boehner said, "Politics, I've had enough of that. I've had enough of that." He prayed at Ground Zero, and he greeted when a little girl in Washington, D.C. jumped the fence, he greeted her with open arms. and gave her a hug, offering you and I an example of what a welcome, a religious welcome, looks like. All right, so, wow, it's already pretty late, but we are only at the intermission. Best one-liners of the year. From Stephen Colbert, a devout Catholic himself. Did you know that? If you want to know if somebody's a Christian, just ask them to complete this sentence. Jesus said, "I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you..." And if they don't say you welcomed me in, they are either a terrorist or, of course, running for president. And one of the best facts that I learned only just a couple weeks ago that I never learned in seminary, again, as a previous Catholic who adores my religious heritage and my religious home, about Harvard historian Wilfred Smith, who likes to talk about the origins of the rosary, the string of beads used for prayers by many Catholics. I still have the one given to me at First Communion. Catholics, and I never knew this, who got the idea from Muslims, from whom prayer beads are common. And the Muslims got the idea from Buddhists, who most likely got the idea from the Indian Brahmins, whose 108 beads account for the requisite number of Hindu prayers. How might the world be different if we listened for the ways that we learn and borrow from each other? All right, back to it. Oh, wait, can I just say one really funny thing that happened over Christmas break that's like one of the funniest things? I like to borrow our church projector. It's got a huge screen. You can put like Xbox games in there. And we turn it on for all the kids, and it says, "Sexuality in Our Faith." Unitarian Universalism, 7th through 9th grade. It is tough to be a minister's kid, let me tell you. The DVD, for in case you're wondering, used by our Whole Lives program. All right, number 5. Courage in response to fear. This is the world. Beautiful and terrible things will happen. Be not afraid. These are the words that I end every one of my emails with. They are by Frederick Buechner, a Presbyterian minister. And I also begin my sermons with him this year. And I do that to remind me and to remind you that our course into politics surely has and surely will continue to be so expert at keeping us fearful and distraught. But I put the words there because I believe that I need to hear there is another way, a way called opposing hatred and fear with courage. This way has been led by example all year, and my hunch is that maybe you missed it like I did. In the Parisians who opened their homes to strangers on the night of the terrifying slaughter there. In Charleston, South Carolina, after a gunman's rampage at the AME church, the victims' families who said, unbelievably, "We forgive you." The mayor who said a hateful person came to this community with a crazy idea that he'd be able to divide, but all he did was unite us and make us love each other even more. And in President Obama, who spoke across politics and preached to the red and blue souls everywhere in the country, when he spoke at the Charleston church a few days later about healing racial divisions, and then he spontaneously began to sing. What did he sing? Amazing Grace. And the whole congregation stood, and I was driving somewhere, and I sung with him that song. How sweet the sound. Days later, the Confederate battle flag came down at the South Carolina state capitol. Are we listening for the sweetness? Or are we just like this, like Heather's story, just looking out at the rain and going, the world sucks? And I use that word intentionally because that's often what I hear people tell me. Are we noticing the courage? How sweet the sound. Number four, we've got the power. And what power is that? It is the power of protest. Now, I've got a confession to make to you. I'm good at those, having done them for so long in my childhood. My confession is that until this year, I have wondered with a little bit of ambivalence about the practice of protest, which I'm sure says much less about the practice and way more about me and my race and my class and my gender and my sexual orientation not provoking me to protest things, as well as my ambivalence coming from listening to my parents, the baby boomers generation, and their friends at dinners share with disillusionment over their own protesting days. All of that kind of sunk into me. But the good thing, remember I turned 44, about growing older is that sometimes you also grow up. Not all the time, sometimes. And you open your eyes to experiences that are not your own. Such learning does not happen all the time, but it happened in me and it happened maybe in you as we watched together the Black Lives Matter movement spread its message of peaceable resistance, drawing support from so many faith traditions, Christians, Jews, Muslims, Unitarian Universalists, all amid increased scrutiny of police killings of Black people. The groundswell of bodies and voices and Twitter hashtags led to many Southern institutions removing their Confederate symbols and led in particular, you may remember, to the resignation of the president and chancellor of the University of Missouri, my dad's alma mater, that was not integrated until 1950. My dad said there was not a single Black or brown face in any class that he had there in 5 years. That boycott or that resignation happened, of course, the boycott, threatened boycott by the Missouri football team, the Tigers. We'll leave for another time why it took the threat of a football team to get the administration's attention. Meanwhile, protests by workers in 270 cities across the country led to a minimum wage increase in 14 states, including our own state of Massachusetts, where did you know that at $10 an hour, we now have the highest minimum wage in the entire country, beginning New Year's Day? A promise to you from me that I will lead us to more places where our religious voice of protest needs to be heard, remembering me with you that we come from the Protestant tradition, that word meaning protest, that's its root. And you know I love roots, protest tradition, and that our mission together is to less reflect the culture that we live in and more to live counter to the culture. Join me. Number three, Abdullah Curtis' Christmas sermon heard in Chicago. Do you know who he is? Well, you remember his son. I know you do. He was three, Aylin was, and he was found face down on a Turkish beach this August. Remember him now? One of over 1 million migrants, many from war-torn Syria, who poured into Europe by sea and land, stirring right-wing resistance in some countries and compassion fatigue in countries that welcomed them. Which is what led Abdullah to deliver his Christmas message on UK's Channel 4 on Christmas Day, in which he said this. If a person shuts the door in somebody's face, this is very difficult. But when a door is open, they no longer feel humiliated. He lost his wife and a son the same day his toddler died. We Syrians leave our country due to war, and we are all afraid for our children, for our honor, he says. So at this time of the year, I would like to ask you, he said, staring into the camera, to think about the pain of fathers and mothers and children who are seeking peace and security. He now lives in Iraq. Meanwhile, in Chicago, it had been a very long and exhausting flight from Cairo for the Syrian family of seven who had fled to Egypt from Syria this year. And when the parents and their children landed in O'Hare, they were warmly greeted by 15 people connected to the First Unitarian Church of Chicago, including seven children who held welcome signs decorated with hand-drawn American and Syrian flags. When the parents and their children, ranging from the age of infant to a teenager, arrived at the apartment that volunteers from the church had furnished for them, they were presented with a hot meal and a refrigerator stocked with all kinds of groceries. While one little girl fell asleep in her new room, Richard Farmer, who launched the congregation's task force to do this earlier this fall, taught the 16-year-old son how to use the Wi-Fi network. Of course he did. Neither I nor the boy spoke a word of the other's language, he said, but gestures and demonstration were all we needed to communicate. Number two, let's just say it plain, no witty titles. The Supreme Court legalizes same-sex marriage. I remember back in my second year of college at Beloit College in Wisconsin, when Paul, one of my best friends then, called a few of us into his dorm room and said he had something to tell us. We were worried for him. Was he sick? Did he have to drop out? I'm gay, he said. You're the first people that I'm telling. I haven't even told my parents yet. And even though I've lost touch with Paul since then, he was among the names and faces I thought of in June when the Supreme Court ruled same-sex marriage was legal, prompting the White House and millions of Facebook profiles, including many of yours, to light up like a giant rainbow. Later that summer, at a pride parade in some Midwestern city, evangelical pastor Adam Phillips picked up a sign and he begins walking, and it reads, "As a Christian, I am sorry for the narrow-minded, judgmental, deceptive, manipulative actions of those who have denied rights and equality to so many in the name of God." Listen to Adam as he describes walking down the street. "It's so incredible to take those steps. I'm walking down Burnside Avenue, and I realize this was not your typical Sunday stroll. Oh, no. I wore my red church pastoral stole. It symbolized the season of Pentecost, which means the coming of the Spirit, and carried that poster in front of me for everybody to see. And I meant it. I meant it. I am sorry," he said, "for the legions of people who have said, done, and prayed unimaginable, exclusionary, and degrading things in the name of God. I am sorry. Anyway, I walked down Burnside Avenue," he says, "and the first parade onlooker squinted and began to read my sign. What does that say? You're sorry? You're sorry? Did they think I was protesting? Did they think I was being, I don't know, would they accept my apology?" He says, "I was overwhelmed, though, by the response. People began to cheer. Then he asked me to slow down so they could take a picture. One woman came up to me and just mouthed the words, 'Thank you. Thank you.'" He says, "I could not handle the acceptance. I couldn't handle the forgiveness. I couldn't handle the small glimpses I witnessed of unfathomable, deep hurt. There was only, though, one feeling that I had, and that feeling was pride." Number one, our top story. "Will the world," she says from the back seat of the car coming home from church, "will the world still be here in 2050? Now, I've said on many occasions that for me, the true religious dialogue happens not from the pulpit, it happens not in the pew, it happens not even in my office, but it happens instead in the car drive home with two children to any number of activities. The too many me's and the too many Karens probing us with theological questions worthy of every and any religious council. Right? For those parents? When they were young, what is a God? What is heaven? How do we get there? Sounds pretty good. Do my hermit crabs have souls? Graduating later to, aren't you the boss of everybody at church? Can't you tell them what to do? But then this fall, after wild weather here at home and discussions about climate change in science class, the younger one asks, just nonchalantly, staring out at the Christmas lights when it was 70 degrees, I'll be like 47 in 2050. She says, and you'll be like, you'll be really old. I hope so, I said. But then, Dad, will there still be a world then? Will there still be a world then? What does one say to that? What does one say to a 12-year-old in words they can hear? At least this year I got to tell her that in Paris, you mean the one where all those people died? The one that we visited? Yes, that Paris. Ella, the nations came together this year. 195 of them, the biggest gathering of nations ever in history, to maybe reach an agreement that may yet answer her heartbreaking question, Dad, will there still be a world then with hope? Because in the same year that this happened, President Obama at long last rejected the Keystone Pipeline. ExxonMobil acknowledged that emissions contribute to climate change. The U.S. has promised to cut carbon emissions by 26%. By 2025. India has put together plans to invest in renewable energy. China and the US announced a joint aggressive agreement on limiting emissions. And if you haven't noticed, we have solar panels on our roof, just like so many other people witnessing and exemplifying a huge rise in renewable energy sources. Can one see a momentum, a political momentum shifting to address this issue? Well, I pray so with you, for my children, for your children, for our children's children. For this is the world that you and I promise at the end of every worship service to go forth into the world in peace with, to act with works of love, to affirm each person's dignity, to affirm every living thing's dignity, and to cherish the living earth. And so my friends, whom I love, you who renew me in so many ways, there are so many stories of redemption and hope this year and every year that help bring some shine, some buff to the world that according to the headlines can seem dark and muddied. Darkness is everywhere. It is raining in a lot of places. Anger and hatred are loud. Tragedy and disaster block the view of the good. The shouting drowns out the quiet. Look, there are always signs, however, of progress and of hope, of willful hope. Look, or you and I may just miss them. Happy New Year.